greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Storytime when we come back. You know, with an income of $50,000, you pay $7,650 in Social Security taxes. That's if you're self-employed and you're paying that 15.3%. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 twice? But the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. Now that means that you pay 17% of the $7,650 twice. Now that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from you and from everyone else that pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears, Penny's, or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? Now, isn't that just kind of special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status calls here at the law school, the number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Well, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for home education, and if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Storytime, a series of stories that I tell from time to time, and I simply put a label on it and call it Storytime. What's the value of a story? Well, Jesus taught in parables. Jesus taught in stories. What value do stories have? Well, in Anglo-Saxon and Celtic tradition, we have always educated by revelation by story. It's only been in the last 100 years or so that we picked up on this scientific or the science model of experimentation. Let's learn from experience. Let's not learn from the old masters. Let's not learn from mom and dad. Let's go out and do it ourselves so we can know for sure. And there's a point to that. That is, when dad tells you that there's going to be a bad outcome. When dad tells you don't smoke because you'll get cancer. See, that's not scientific. That's revelation. And so, we have decided, here in America at least, and I suspect in most of the Western Anglo-Saxon or Celtic countries, that we prefer the scientific model to the revelatory model. In the Garden of Eden, there was a revelation. The revelation was this. There's a tree in the midst of the garden. That tree is poison to you. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If you eat off of that tree, you will surely die. So along comes Satan, and he says, hey, has God told you that you'll die if you eat off that tree? And Eve said, yep, that's what he's told us. That's revelation. And Satan said, you know he's lying to you. And if you eat off that tree, you will not surely die. And so Eve thought about it for a minute, and she said, well, the tree looks good. I mean, it just looks real good. And so I think I'll go ahead and eat off that tree. I'm going to conduct the world's first scientific experiment. She ate off the tree, and she didn't die. And she said, I knew it. I knew that God was a liar. Adam comes tripping along, and so she says, "Hey, Adam, look off this tree over here. I've been eating off of this tree, and I didn't die." Adam looks at her eating the fruit, and he says, "Well, look at that. She's eating that fruit, and she doesn't die." Adam ate off of the tree. He didn't die. And in their limited realm of experience, they came to the conclusion that God was lying to them, that God was a big liar. He told them that in the day that they ate off that tree, they would surely die. They ate off the tree and they didn't die. Satan had told them the truth. They had experimented with it. They had the evidence in their hand. Science does that to this day. Science experiments, and they come up with great pronouncements, and they tell us great things. And then some years later, they come back after they've had some more experience and say, "You know, maybe our original pronouncement on the subject over here isn't quite correct, so we're going to have to review that. We've reviewed it, and we've come to the conclusion it's an error, so we're going to have to rewrite the textbooks." And so they come back and they rewrite the textbooks. That's what we got with Piltdown Men. That was a mistake. And the science textbooks of today will be the laughingstock of the future. And the science textbooks of yesteryear are the laughingstocks of today. That's what experimentation does. In fact, scientists will tell you, well, the science model is a series of self-corrections. That is, we come up with a theory, and then we go out and we experiment, and then we find out that what we believe, and then we write that down, and then we experiment with it some time, and we come to a conclusion that, well, maybe it's not right, and so therefore we have to correct it. So it's self-correcting. That's why science is always wrong. Science and the experimental model is always wrong. They've been telling us for the last 50 years, at least during my lifetime, last 50 years, they're going to come up with a cure to cancer. They don't have a cure to cancer. They're no closer to a cure to cancer today than they were 50 years ago. Allopathic medicine tells you very plainly, we don't know what causes cancer. We don't know how to cure it. And people flock to those people. They flock to the oncologist to be treated for cancer, knowing full well that the oncologist cannot cure it and doesn't know what causes it. It's bizarre. It's off the charts insofar as common sense is concerned, but you know, that's the way people are. I'm not here to correct people. I'm just here to reveal to you it doesn't make any sense. Adam and Eve, from their limited perspective in life, having not lived yet for 930 years, did not know, did not grasp the significance of the statement that said, "In the day that you eat off of that tree, you will surely die." That was a true statement that came from revelation. It came from their creator. Their creator was smarter than the creation. The engineers who design the 747 are smarter than the airplane itself. Oh, the airplane has got a lot of technology in it, and it's got computers, and it's pretty smart. But it isn't as smart as the Boeing people that created it. Now, Adam and Eve were real smart people, no doubt about that. They were created with a certain amount of intelligence, but they didn't quite know it all. And from their limited perspective, they experimented and came to the conclusion that eating off of that tree will not kill you. That was wrong. And 930 years later, Adam died. He's dead today. So is Eve. The statement that God made could be construed in two ways. In the day that you eat thereof, you'll surely die. That is, instantaneously, like taking strychnine. When you eat, you will go into convulsions and die on the spot. That's one construction of the statement. The second construction, in the day that you eat thereof, you'll surely die. In the day that you eat off of that tree, the ultimate outcome is going to be your death, but not necessarily on that particular day. It's going to come at a time and place, and it did. So both were telling Adam and Eve the truth. The scientific experiment that they conducted, in fact, produced a true, accurate, and correct result. They did not die on that day, June 13th, 4004 BC, or whatever date it was. But they did ultimately die. So their revelation, their revelator, told them the truth, and they didn't understand it. They didn't grasp it at the time. And that's the purpose and the point of a story. The purpose and point of a story is to give you a revelation. Sometimes stories are true, sometimes stories are parables. A parable isn't necessarily a true story, it's a story that, if it were acted out, would come out with this result based upon human nature. So Jesus told a number of parables. Some of them were probably true, just like we have a parable, a story called the Three Little Pigs. And the point of the story is to encourage you to build your house upon a strong foundation, to build it out of brick, build out of something of substance, so that it will last, so that it will withstand Hurricane Katrina. The experience from the story, The Three Little Pigs, translates into building codes. The reason that we have building codes is because from experience we can see what Hurricane Katrina will do. And therefore, we say, in the future, we need to build our houses out of bricks rather than straw, so that when the big wind comes, you know, it isn't because we believe that a wolf is going to come and huff and puff and blow our house down now, is it? I mean, when was the last time you saw a wolf come down the street and blow somebody's house down? So we tell a little child that story, and the little child then grows up, and he has a concept in his mind. I remember the first time I heard that story, I was scared of wolves from that point on in time. You know, to this day, I still have a bad connotation concerning wolves because of that story. So maybe it's not a good story to tell the little kids when they're 4 years old, but it's certainly a good point in learning construction. And so as a general contractor, the story of the three little pigs is always in the back of my mind as I'm building a house or a garage or I'm building a project. Put an extra nail or two in there so that when the strong winds come, it doesn't blow it down. So that's the value of a story. A story is a revelation. It can be a simile, an anomaly. It can be a parable. It can be a true story, an actual event that transpired that we all learn from. Now, most people don't recognize these stories today. Stories used to be the modality by which we taught. And we'd sit around. This is before television, you know, and radio and so on. We'd sit around and tell stories. And these stories would instruct us. The purpose of a story is instruction. It's education. Now, of course, today, you know, you want to go to college and be instructed out of a glossy textbook, you know, that's got tables and numbers in it, that has experimentation, that has some science behind it. And this is what we do. We go to college and we learn from these books. And then we get out into the real world. I got to tell you a story about the real world. In America, Johnny can't read. And in America, for the last 50 years, Johnny not only can't read, his reading ability is deteriorating with each and every passing year. If we take a look at the students, let's say in the year 2000, and compare them with the students in the year 1960, their test scores are way below what they were in 1960. And they've been going down, down, down ever since. And so, in this country, we've been trying to figure out, well, what do we need to do to educate people? And so the answer is smaller class sizes and more money. So we've been spending more money. We spend more money than anybody else in the world. $9,000 to educate a child for 1 year. Much is that for 12 years? 12 times 9,000. It's $108,000 to educate a child in the American public school system. And when he gets out of high school, he probably is going to have a hard time reading the diploma. Now, they're in Washington, D.C. They had a little piece on the Laren NewsHour the other day, and I got a new lady there. She's a Korean. She's the new school superintendent, and she's going to take over the Washington, D.C. schools and straighten them out. And they've got students in high school that can't read at the third grade level. I don't know how those students got to be high school boys and girls if they can't read at the third grade level, because when I went to public school, if you couldn't read at the third grade level, you couldn't go to the fourth grade. So you'd have to repeat the third grade. I guess the theory behind it was that 2 years in the third grade, probably you'd learn how to read, and then you could go on to the fourth grade. If it was a requirement that you stay 2 years in each grade, by the time you got to be 18 years old, you might only be in the sixth grade. You'd have a sixth grade education. And then they turn those kids loose. Well, for some reason, there's a stigma that goes with that. I can remember as a child that if you didn't pass, I mean, the worst thing that could happen is that you were held back. And I knew a few kids that were held back, and they had this stigma attached to them, you know, dummy, dummy, mental retard, dummy. Well, that's the breaks of the game. That happened to one kid out of 30, maybe, in the third grade. All 32 of us passed into the fourth grade. So in 1946, 47, 48, along in there, we could read. We didn't have any problems reading. Now, today we have a problem with Johnny reading. So the other day, down in, it's out in California, in Stanford, California, they've got a new program over there. They've taken developmentally challenged, that is, retarded people, and put them into the college. You got a college program for retarded people, mentally retarded. And so they're sending these mentally retarded people into college. Now, up until now, somebody with Down's syndrome or autism would be excluded from the college scene because they academically couldn't meet the challenge. Evidently, they have lowered the bars. I mean, obviously, these people, if they're mentally challenged, they're not going to be able to keep up with the guys, you know, that are have IQs of 180, you know, or something like that. So they got to have a special class for them. So they do. They got a special class. They got 24 students, and they're in these special classes. Now, they interviewed one of these young girls. She's probably 18, 19, 20 years old. She has Down syndrome. And the interviewer said, well, what do you want to do when you graduate from college? And she says, I want to be a teacher. And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, now that's novel. That's novel. There's a parable in the Bible, and it says, when the blind lead the blind, they both fall in the ditch. Jesus said that. When a blind man leads a blind man, they both fall in the ditch. Now, it's a tragedy when somebody is blind. But would we want a blind man to be leading somebody, or a group of people, let's say on a cross-country trip? Now, if you're sitting out there like I am saying, well, that doesn't make any sense, that's the purpose for the parable in the Bible. It is a story that says, that is so ridiculous, that is so off the wall, that it's laughable. And so we use this little parable and we say, when the blind lead the blind, they both fall in the ditch. That's very logical. I mean, you don't have to have a great imagination to figure out that if you've got a blind man out here and he's leading another blind man, at some point in time, they're both going to fall in the ditch. And so here's this young woman who is mentally retarded, and she wants to be a teacher. Now, does somebody have it in their minds that because Johnny can't read, from the teachers that we have in our public school system today who are not mentally retarded, therefore, if we were to educate Johnny with a teacher who is mentally retarded, we couldn't get a worse result? Now, if that's the moral to the story, that's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. I would agree with that. I mean, if you've got an incompetent teacher now trying to teach Johnny to read, and she can't do that, she can't get Johnny to read. And if you were to send a mentally retarded person into the classroom to teach Johnny to read, he probably couldn't learn to read either. And so, therefore, we would look at that and say, well, that's pretty laughable. But I don't think that that's very funny, because these people are serious. They are going to send these people to college. These people are going to come out of that college with a degree. And then there are going to be laws that say you cannot discriminate against people because they have autism or because they have Down syndrome. You know, we already have those laws on the books. Therefore, when a school administrator has to hire somebody to fill a vacancy, he has to give the same kind of consideration to the young woman here, who in this case has Down syndrome, for this position of teaching in the school as he would to somebody that has an IQ that's normal or maybe a little above normal. In fact, you may even have a system where this discrimination has been going on and it's been so rampant for so long that what we need to do is to change that system of discrimination like we do with blacks and then put them to the head of the line. Now, let me ask you this. Do you want to send your child to a school where the teacher has Down syndrome? I mean, I have to laugh a little bit here. It's not because I'm laughing at somebody that has Down syndrome. It's that you're going to take somebody who's blind and put them out here leading other people who are blind. Don't you think that is stupid? You know, lacking a vocabulary to describe this in more articulate terms. It sounds stupid to me. So, with that much of an introduction to the concept of story time, let me tell you a story. It's a story about insurance. It's a story about insurance companies. It's revelatory, and it's a true story. This is the way the insurance industry works. If you think that insurance companies are designed to keep you in safe hands, then you've been led by a blind teacher. If you believe that insurance companies are there to help you when you've had a disaster, you're being led by fools. That's not the purpose of the insurance industry. Let me tell you what it is. The purpose for insurance is profit. Insurance companies exist for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to make profit for the stockholders. It's the only reason that business exists. There isn't a single business anywhere in the world that operates for any cause, reason, or purpose other than making profit. It's the only purpose for business. Businesses don't exist for any other purpose. Even a non-profit business operates for profit. Because if it didn't, it couldn't stay in business. Every business has to pay its expenses. And if it can't pay its expenses, it goes out of business. It's just that simple. So insurance companies are profit-making institutions, and they're there to make profit. Now, they lie to you, and they tell you that in the day that you eat thereof, you will not surely die. In the day that you pay your premiums, you will not have a disaster. And if a disaster occurs, the insurance company will be there. That's a true statement. If you pay your insurance premiums, disaster will not automatically overtake you. And if you pay your premiums and the disaster does in time come, the insurance company will be there. That does not mean that they're going to pay you your claim. And remember, from your perspective, the purpose for you paying the premium is so that you can collect on your claim. That's your perspective. From the perspective of the insurance company, we're here to collect premiums, and we are not here to pay out claims. So the insurance company is going to collect your premiums and do everything in their power not to pay you the claim. And you're going to pay your premium with every intention of collecting that claim. Now, that's the equivalent of the immovable object being struck by the irresistible force. And when that happens, you will not get paid your claim. So let me tell you about Emil Crow. Emil Crow was an old-timey insurance adjuster. And Emil Crow was also an attorney. an attorney, and a claims adjuster. Now, claims adjusting is a very lucrative business, especially if you're a freelance insurance claims adjuster. That is, you're working for a number of companies on percentage. You're like a salesman that gets paid a commission. You get paid for what you do. You don't get paid a salary. You don't get paid by the hour. And Emil had the southern tier of counties working for the Travelers Insurance Company, which was one company that he represented in what we call the southern tier of counties over to the Boot Heel here in Missouri. So over to Sykeston, which is over on the Mississippi River, and over here to Joplin, Missouri, is the southern tier of counties. Probably 15 counties in all. Well, sure enough, one day the Travelers Insurance Company had one of their policyholders involved in an auto accident, and Emil was called by Travelers to go out and investigate the accident. Now, the first thing that a claims adjuster does is he goes out and he looks at the maximum possible liability that the company might have. First thing we want to know, what's the maximum possible liability? Well, this guy has a $50,000 policy. Now, this is 1950. A $50,000 insurance policy in 1950 is a god-awful big insurance policy. Big, big, big insurance policy. Normal policy would be about 20% of that, about $10,000. Maybe with a double indemnity payout of $20,000, $10,000, $20,000. But this guy's got $50,000. So it's a big policy. And the insurance company guards the policy limit with their lives because they don't want anybody to know what the stakes are that we're playing for. So if you want to know what the policy limit is, you're not going to find out. In fact, even the courts protect that policy limit by rule. So Emil comes back and says, well, the maximum policy limit is $50,000. And there's more than $50,000 worth of damage. Therefore, the insurance company is on the hook for the full $50,000. Emil goes out and talks to the victim, and not the policyholder, now the victim. And then he says, you're in safe hands with the Travelers Insurance Company. We're here to help. And so he talks to the guy several times, and he gets his statement, and he gets the story together. And he stretches this out for 2 or 3 months. This guy's in the hospital for 2 or 3 months. Nobody was killed. No deaths involved, but there was a lot of property damage, a lot of hospital bills and so on. And so when it's all said and done, some time goes by, and this guy says, I've got to have some money to pay the hospital because the hospital's on it. He hasn't been working for 3 months, and so his mortgage payment needs to be made. And so this guy is in desperate straits for money. And that's the point. That's the purpose behind all of this. This is why insurance companies are so slow in making their payments. It's to run you out of money. It's to make you desperate for money. You see this with Hurricane Katrina victims down on the Gulf Coast. When you're desperate for money, you will settle for much less. And that's the objective here, is to get you to settle for less. On day one, yeah, there's over $50,000 worth of damage. That doesn't mean that we want to pay you $50,000 because you're in safe hands. It means that we want to pay you as little as possible. Now, Emil Crow gets paid a portion of what it is he saves the company. The reason that they do this is to give Emil, that is to give their claims adjuster, all the incentive they possibly can to settle for the least amount of money possible. So Emil gets 50% of what he saves on the claim. So the first thing they decide is that, yes, indeed, there's a $50,000 liability. If Emil could settle the case for, let's say, half, $25,000, he would save the company $25,000, and the company would be happy to give Emil $12,500, or 50% of what he saved the company on the claim. Since the claim is going to exceed $50,000, they figure if it goes to a jury trial, they'll probably lose, probably have to pay the whole $50,000, And Amel isn't going to get paid anything. So Amel isn't going to settle this for $50,000. He's going to settle for something less than $50,000. And so when you go out and hire an attorney, your attorney knows that. He doesn't tell you that, but he knows that. And so Amel comes to this guy and he says, hey, we think there's contributory negligence here. And because there's contributory negligence, we're not gonna pay you. But he said, there is some negligence, so I'm prepared to pay you $7,000. And this guy is just incensed that he would come in here and offer him such a lowball figure. He says, I'm gonna hire a lawyer. Well, that's exactly what Amel Crow wants him to do, because see, Amel's a lawyer. And one shark talks to another shark in shark language. It's hard to deal, you know, with somebody if this person is the victim. But now, it's easier to talk to the victim's lawyer, because after all, the victim's lawyer and Amel, who is also a lawyer, are going to be talking in, well, how much are we going to make off of this deal? So the lawyer working for the victim is charging one-third of what he recovers. So he's hired and he says, okay, I'll go in and represent you. And if I settle this case for $25,000, you have to give me $6,000 and some change. Or $8,000 and some change. It'd be one-third of what I settle for. And so the guy says, well, since they're going to settle with $7,000 for me, if this guy can get me $25,000, it would be worth giving him the $8,000, because then I'm going to make an extra $8,000. So with this much set in stone, let me give you your mid-course reminder, and we'll be back with more on the Amel Crow insurance story right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the webpage as well. Now, The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about story time. The Amel Crow story. By the way, this is a true story related to me by Amel himself, live and direct. All right, so now with contributory negligence on the table, the two lawyers sit down to decide the victim's fate. Amel, being very shrewd as a businessman and a claims adjuster, after all, a lawyer is a businessman. He's an entrepreneur. He's in business to make as much money as possible on each and every case that he takes. He wants to maximize his profit, just like any other businessman wants to maximize his profit. A building contractor wants to maximize the sale price of the house. He wants to maximize his profit by paying his workers less money. That being the case, and everybody in the business world understands that, I'm pretty sure. Amel sits down with the guy and says, the policy limit's $20,000. He understates the policy limit. A $20,000 policy limit would be very reasonable. And he said, but we think there's contributory negligence, and here's what we think is that negligence, and if this case goes to trial, we think that in the final analysis, we're going to pay some damages, but it's not going to be the full $20,000. And you might get a $50,000 deficiency judgment against my client over here, but he doesn't have anything, and he'll go file for bankruptcy. And so you're going to get nothing more than what we're going to settle for here in the $20,000 policy limit. Now remember, the real policy limit's $50,000, so Amel's lying to the guy, just like Satan lied to Eve. He doesn't deny that there's a policy limit. He doesn't deny that we've got some fault. He just says it ain't that big. So the attorney for the other side says, well, then the logical thing to do is to settle for. And so Amel says, well, we could settle this case for about $17,500. You got to leave $2,500 on the table so that I can get paid 50% of the $2,500 that I saved the company, which is $1,250. If I don't get $1,250, we go to trial. So he goes back to his client and he says, okay, here's the settlement, $17,500. Here's why it's a good settlement. Here's why you should settle. And here's what's going to happen if you don't settle. So the guy says, well, I guess that's the logical thing for me to do. So they settle for $17,500. The theory behind it from the victim's point of view is that that leaves $2,500 on the table. Travelers gets $1,250. Amel gets $1,250. The victim gets $17,500. Now, the $17,500, we got to take a third off of it. So, it takes $17,500 times 0.333, and that gives us $5,827.50. That goes to the victim's lawyer. $5,827.50. So, if we take our $17,500... and we take the $5,825.50. That leaves $11,674.50 for the victim. $5,825.50 for the lawyer's, the victim's lawyer. Now, since the real policy limit was $50,000, and they settled for $17,500, then it looks like we have about $32,500 in savings, doesn't it? So if we take $32,500 and we divide that by 2, $32,500 divided by 2 leaves $16,250 for Amel Crow and $16,250 for the insurance company. Now, is this good business? Good business for the travelers. Good business for Amel Crow. It's not good business for the victim. The victim gets paid $11,500 in round numbers. Amel Crow gets paid $16,000. Why should the claims adjuster get paid more money than the victim of the wreck? That's why I'm here to report to you through this story that insurance is a bad business. It's a bad business for the policyholder. Insurance is a bad business for victims. There are other things that are wrong with insurance. This is just one story out of many to illustrate to you that strict liability, which is the biblical rule, is a better program than insurance. Now, I know that most Americans don't believe that. Most Americans aren't going to hear this story. But I wanted to report it to you because this is the actual, down-to-earth, everyday, garden-variety modality behind insurance companies, insurance and insurance claims and settlements. This is the way it works out on the street. So if you've been screwed, blued, and tattooed by your insurance company, it was designed that way. If you're paying insurance premiums and you believe that at some point in the future, if you have your house burned down or you have a hurricane or something, then you're going to get paid, and that you've got visions of having a brand new house built for you by the insurance company, you're living in la-la land. You've got the head, your head, up the wrong end of your anatomy again. That's the bottom line. That isn't the way the game is played. Now that you've heard the Emil Crow story, you will be able to remember that story much better than an abstract college textbook describing for you the modality by which the insurance company pays its claims adjusters. I'm an old-timey claims adjuster. I know how it works. My dad was in the insurance sales business, and he had to work hard for his customers to help them with their claims, because the claims adjuster was trying to screw them, and my dad was trying to help them get their claim through, because after all, that was his business, selling insurance and collecting premiums. Claims adjusters work the other end of the scale. The insurance company works both ends of the scale for profit. That's the way the game is played. All right, now with that much under our belts, let's take a look at the Dennis story over here. I won't use his last name because he might be a little skittish about that. But let's tell you about Dennis on distressed property. Distressed property. Good way to make money. I've been in the distressed property business most of my building career. Distressed property are properties that are beat up and run down. They're properties that nobody else can handle. They may be in a bad neighborhood. They may be in a declining city. It may be a house full of termites or something on that order. A house full of termites may not be worth $200,000, but maybe it's worth $100,000. Maybe it's worth $50,000. Maybe it's worth $25,000. It's got a value, even if we tear the house down and rebuild it. It's got a value. It's got a lot value. It's got a water meter out in front. It's got utilities. Well, in Little Rock, Arkansas, there's distressed property because Little Rock is turning black. And as cities turn from white to black, we call this white flight. This white flight creates distressed properties. It creates a deterioration in property values. As blacks move into a neighborhood, the whites move out. And as the whites move out to other towns like Conway, they need to get rid of their houses. And so Dennis comes along and he takes a house that has a $14,000 balance on it. In other words, the white guy that lives in this house still owes the bank $14,000. This neighborhood is going black. And he's unable to sell it for whatever reason. And he says, I need to get out of here. Banks won't lend to blacks in the same way that they lend to whites. And so black people have a hard time buying houses in any neighborhood. That being the case, then there's an opportunity here in a distressed neighborhood. Dennis goes to the guy who wants to get rid of his house and says, I'll buy your house on a contract for deed. I will take over your payments and I will pay out these payments over the next 10 years, whatever it happens to be. Now, this house is probably worth about $30,000. I mean, if it was out on the marketplace, you know, it should bring $30,000, but, you know, it can't bring $30,000 because the neighborhood's going down. And so the guy that's got it wants to get out, and he says, I would be happy if I just could leave here and I don't have to pay this $14,000. Dennis then takes over the house. He rents it to a black tenant. Now, the black tenant comes in and rents the house for $300 a month, maybe $350. some cases maybe even 400, I don't know. But he's renting this house, let's say, for $300 a month. And that's because he can't qualify for a bank loan. He'd like to buy the house. He'd like to buy any house. But, you know, he can't because he doesn't have the credit rating to do that. And so Dennis comes up to the guy and he says, would you like to buy this house? And the guy says, God, yeah, I'd like to buy this house. Okay. I will sell you this house on a contract for deed. And I won't charge you interest. You don't have to pay any interest. You don't have to pay any points, closing costs, no credit reports, no prepayment penalties, no loan origination fees, no down payment. How do you like a deal like that? No down. No loan origination fee. No prepayment penalties. No closing costs. No credit reports. No points. No interest. That no interest is very important because a 6% loan for 30 years doubles the price of the property. So if you were to buy a piece of property at 6% interest, $14,000, no money down, over 30 years, you would pay $30,000 for the property. In this case, Dennis says, but you can't have 30 years to pay for it. You've got to pay for it in 7 years. 7 years, because there's a year of release in Leviticus chapter 25. And here in America, in 1928, the longest mortgage you could get was 30 years. Excuse me, 7 years. Roosevelt came along and extended that to 10 years. That was about 1934 or 5. And then little by little, they went from 10 years to 15 years, and then to 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. Last time I heard, you can get a mortgage for 40 years, interest only. You never own the house. You just pay the interest on it. And Americans evidently think that's a good deal. And they buy these kind of houses. This is why we have a housing crisis in America today. And that's because Americans can't count. They can't do arithmetic. They can't do percentages. And so the best they can do is to follow the instructions that they receive from their attorneys and from their real estate brokers and agents and so on. And they just sign. They don't count. They don't add. They don't subtract. When I'm watching the news, and I'm watching here, you know, nearly every night, there'll be some segment about some homeowner that took one of these low-interest loans, one of these accelerated loans or something, an ABS loan or a subprime loan, and now he can't make the payments. And he's just bewildered. I just don't understand it. Well, he's been to public school. That should tell you the whole story. That this poor guy's been to public school. He can't add, he can't subtract, he can't read, he can't write. But he's educated. He has a high school diploma. He probably can't read his high school diploma, but he's got one. Johnny can't read, but he's got a diploma. All right, so now there's the background. Is this a good deal for the black guy? It's a deal made in heaven. But here's the payment terms. He has to pay. Now, this is back a few years ago when gold was about $300 an ounce. You know, around 2000. Gold was about $300 an ounce. So he said to the guy, well, you got to pay me in gold coin. Gold coin being $50 eagles. And so if you just take he sold him the house for $30,000. Let's take $30,000. And we divide that, $30,000, by $300 an ounce. And that's 100 ounces of gold. So he says to the black guy, he says, now, will you pay me 100 ounces of gold times $50 an ounce, which is $5,000 in U.S. gold coin? Black guy says, well, I don't know, I guess. Price of gold's $300 an ounce. Now, the black guy has to pay 100 ounces of gold, $5,000 in U.S. gold coin. This is called a gold contract. Comes under Title 31, in case you want to check this out. Title 31, Section 5102 through 5112. Congress has said there's no difference between a $50 bill and a $50 gold piece. Well, you know, Satan told Eve, you know, you will not surely die if you eat off that tree. That was the truth. It is true that there's no difference between a $50 bill and a $50 gold piece. At least it's true when you go to pay your taxes. The IRS will take your $50 gold piece and they'll give you $50 worth of credit. But it isn't true that it's only worth 50, because you can take the same $50 down, the same gold piece down to a gold broker, and he'll give you today about $750 for it in paper. So paper and gold do not have the same value, but Congress tells you it does. But then that's what Satan told Eve, you know. So there's a lot of lying that goes on. Dennis isn't lying to anybody. Told the guy the truth. Now take 7 years and divide that into 100. 100 divided by 7 is 14.28. So the guy has to pay 14.28 ounces per year. Divided by 12 is 1.2 ounces per month. So that's one $50 gold piece and two $5 gold pieces. So that's $60 a month in U.S. gold coin. That's the payment. And when he makes when he makes 84 of those payments, he gets the house. So he's actually going to pay $30,000 for the house, which the house is worth $30,000. If this guy could borrow the money, it'd be worth that. But he can't borrow the money because the banks won't lend it to him. Why won't the banks lend it to him? Because his credit isn't any good. Why isn't his credit any good? He's black. So it's not Dennis that's discriminating against the guy. It's the banks that are discriminating against blacks, isn't it? I don't know if the guy's credit worthy or not. All I'm telling you is the guy's black. He's in a declining neighborhood. The whites are moving out. That's life. That's where the marketplace is. That's where reality is. Dennis moves in. He buys the house for $14,000 on a contract from deed from the white guy that's leaving town, sells it for $30,000, doubles his money, and over a period of 7 years, he gets paid. You know, for all of the time, effort, and energy that he puts into the transaction. Is that good business? It's good business for the black guy. It's good business for Dennis, the white guy. It's good business for the guy that wants to get out of Dodge. Is there business to be done out there? You bet. Now, this is typically underground business. We call this the black market. You know, at least most people call it the black market. But it's the underground economy. And this kind of business goes on all over America, goes on all over Russia, China, goes on all over the world. In fact, here in the United States, to give you an illustration as to how much business is being conducted, our economy is approximately $13 trillion a year. That's what they tell us. It's really not that high because most of it's inflated dollars being pumped into circulation through the Fed and the open money markets, but then that's another story for another day. But they tell us it's 13. It's probably more like about 9. Now, out of this $13 trillion, though, about 25% of the economy is being done under the table, being done privately, that's not being done on the books, not being recorded by the Department of Commerce, not being reported by the banks, just private transactions like this one right here I described, about 25%. So there's about in round numbers, $2.5 to $3 trillion a year in the underground economy. If that it was in the above ground economy, and if there was taxes being paid on it, there probably wouldn't be any budget deficits. We probably would be able to collect enough tax money to balance our budget, in all probability. But the moral of the story is that isn't where the real world is. Now, there's about $3 trillion a year, then, that's being transacted by Americans in our economy. And it's probably a major reason as to why our economy hasn't collapsed yet. And that's because there's a lot of business going on. A lot of people are being supported by buying, selling, trading, doing business, accomplishing their goals without paying taxes on them. But that's where the real world is. And there's the story of Dennis. Now, the underground economy is a very vibrant economy. It goes on in Kosovo. It goes on in Bosnia. During the Bosnian War, coffee was selling for $4 a cup and gasoline was $20 a gallon. That was back in 1995. $20 a gallon for gas. There was no shortage of gasoline. There was no shortage of coffee at $4 a cup and $20 a gallon. You can rest assured that if there's money to be made, there will be somebody there to provide the goods and services that you want. If you've got the money, the goods and services will be there. To demonstrate that, there is no shortage of cocaine in America. And there's no shortage of marijuana in this country either. In fact, marijuana is the biggest cash crop produced in the United States of America. It is a $37 billion a year crop. It is bigger than wheat, corn, soybeans, and cotton. So if you're a farmer and you're producing wheat, soybeans, or cotton, hey, you're not where the money's at. The money is in marijuana. And there's no shortage of it. And there's no price supports. And you taxpayers out there, you're not paying any of those marijuana farmers, you know, soil bank money and tax money or price supports. No siree, Bob. Those guys are out there, they buy and pay for their own fertilizer. They don't even plant the stuff on their own land. They're probably out here planting it on the national forest. But there's no shortage of marijuana, as indicated by the free market price. In fact, over the last 5 years, the price of cocaine has gone down 25% here in America. And if you get caught with this cocaine, you could go to jail. Now, that's just a testimony to the free marketplace. So learn a lesson. Stories are very valuable. Stories tell you where the truth is. A story, like a parable from Jesus, tells you where the real world is, where the real world functions. Remember that revelation tells you before the fact. Experimentation tells you after the fact. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. And remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All of these Law Hour programs are carried over the Internet worldwide. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.